Don't be afraid. As Englewood gained population, Holmes's sales of tonics and lotions increased. By the end of 1886, the pharmacy was running smoothly and profitably. His thoughts turned now to a woman he had met earlier in the year during his brief stay in Minneapolis, Myrta Z. Belknap. She was young and blonde, with blue eyes and a lush figure, but what elevated her above mere beauty was the aura of vulnerability and need that surrounded her. She became an immediate obsession, her image and need locked in his brain. He traveled to Minneapolis, ostensibly on business. He had no doubt he would succeed. It amused him that women as a class were so wonderfully vulnerable, as if they believed the codes of conduct that applied in their safe little hometowns, like Alva, Clinton, and Percy, might actually still apply once they had set out on their own and left their dusty, kerosene-scented parlors behind. The city toughened them quickly, however. Best to catch them at the start of their ascent toward freedom, in transit from small places when they were anonymous, lost, their presence recorded nowhere. Every day he saw them, stepping from trains and grip cars and hansom cabs, inevitably frowning at some piece of paper that was supposed to tell them where they belonged. The city's madams understood this, and were known to meet inbound trains with promises of warmth and friendship, saving the important news for later. Holmes adored Chicago, adored in particular how the smoke and din could envelop a woman and leave no hint that she ever had existed, save perhaps a blade-thin track of perfume amid the stench of dung, anthracite, and putrefaction. To Myrta, Holmes seemed to have stepped from a world far more exciting than her own. She lived with her parents and clerked in a music store. Minneapolis was small, somnolent, and full of Swedish and Norwegian farmers as charming as cornstalks. Holmes was handsome, warm, and obviously wealthy, and he lived in Chicago, the most feared and magnetic of cities. Even during their first meeting, he touched her. His eyes deposited a bright blue hope. When he left the store that first day, as motes of dust filled the space he left behind, her own life seemed drab beyond endurance. A clock ticked. Something had to change. When his first letter arrived, asking sweetly if he might court her, she felt as if a coarse blanket had been lifted from her life. Every few weeks he returned to Minneapolis. He told her about Chicago. He described its skyscrapers and explained how each year the buildings grew taller and taller. He told her pleasantly shocking stories of the stockyards, how the hogs climbed the bridge of size to an elevated platform, where chains were attached to their hind legs, and they were swept away, shrieking, along an overhead track down into the bloody core of the slaughterhouse. And romantic stories. How Potter Palmer had been so in love with his wife, Bertha, that he had given her a luxurious hotel, the Palmer House, as a wedding present. There were rules about courtship. Although no one set them down on paper, every young woman knew them and knew instantly when they were being broken. Holmes broke them all, and with such forthright lack of shame that it became clear to Myrta that the rules must be different in Chicago. At first it frightened her, but she found quickly that she liked the heat and risk. When Holmes asked her to be his wife, she accepted immediately. They married on January 28, 1887. Holmes neglected to tell Myrta that he already had a wife, Clara Lovering, the original Mrs. Herman Webster Mudgett. 2 weeks after marrying Myrta, he filed a petition in the Supreme Court of Cook County, Illinois, to divorce Lovering. This was no fine-spirited gesture to clear the record. He charged Lovering with infidelity, a ruinous accusation. He allowed the petition to lapse, however, and eventually the court dismissed it for failure to prosecute. In Chicago, Murta saw at once that the stories Holmes had told of the city only barely captured its glamour and dangerous energy. It was like a cauldron of steaming iron, trains everywhere, jarring, but also a reminder that life had opened to her at last. In Minneapolis, there had been only silence and the inevitable clumsy petitions of potato-fingered men looking for someone, anyone, to share the agony of their days. That Holmes lived in Englewood, not the heart of Chicago, was at first a disappointment, but here, too, there was a vibrancy far beyond what she had experienced at home. She and Holmes settled into the second-floor apartment previously occupied by Mrs. Holton. By the spring of 1888, Murta was pregnant. At first, she helped run the drugstore. She liked working with her husband and often watched him when he was engaged with a customer. She savored his looks and blue calm and craved the moments when, in the course of routine tasks, their bodies would touch. She admired, too, the charm with which he managed each transaction and how he won the business even of elderly customers loyal to the absent Mrs. Holton. And she smiled, at least initially, as each in a seemingly endless train of young women entered the store, insisting that only direct consultation with Dr. Holmes himself would suffice. Murta came to see that underneath her husband's warm and charming exterior, there flowed a deep current of ambition. He seemed a druggist in name only. He more closely fit the prevailing ideal of the self-made man who, through hard work and invention, pulled himself, rung by rung, into the upper strata of society. "Ambition has been the curse of my husband's life," Murta said later. "He wanted to attain a position where he would be honored and respected. He wanted wealth." She insisted, however, that his ambition never impaired his character and never distracted him from his role as husband and eventually father. Holmes, she swore, had a gentle heart. He adored children and animals. He was a lover of pets and always had a dog or cat, and usually a horse, and he would play with them by the hour, teaching them little tricks or romping with them. He neither drank nor smoked and did not gamble. He was affectionate and impossible to ruffle. "In his home life, I do not think there was ever a better man than my husband," Murta said. "He never spoke an unkind word to me or our little girl or my mother. He was never vexed or irritable, but was always happy and free from care." Yet, from the start, tension suffused their marriage. Holmes expressed no hostility. The heat came from Murta, who quickly tired of all those young female customers and the way Holmes would smile at them and touch them and channel his blue gaze into their eyes. At first, she had found it appealing. Then it made her uneasy. Finally, it made her jealous and watchful. Her increasing possessiveness did not anger Holmes. Rather, he came to see her as an obstacle, just as a sea captain might view an iceberg, something to monitor and avoid. Business was so good, he told Murta, that he needed her help managing the store's books. She found herself spending more and more time in an office upstairs, writing correspondence and preparing invoices for the drugstore. She wrote to her parents of her sorrow. In the summer of 1888, her parents moved to Wilmette, Illinois, where they occupied a pretty two-story house on John Street opposite a church. Lonely, sad, and pregnant, Murta joined them at the house and there bore a daughter, Lucy. Suddenly, Holmes began acting like a dutiful husband. Murta's parents were cool at first, but he courted their approval with moist-eyed declarations of regret and displays of adoration for his wife and child. He succeeded. His presence, Murta said, was like oil on troubled waters, as mother often said to him. He was so kind, so gentle and thoughtful, that we forgot our cares and worries. He begged their forbearance for his lengthy absences from the Wilmeet house. There was so much to do in Chicago. From the way he dressed and the money he gave Murta, he certainly seemed like a man on the rise, and this perception went a long way to ease the concerns of Murta's parents. They and Murta settled into a life marked by increasingly widespread visits from Dr. Holmes, but when he did appear, he brought warmth and gifts and entombed little Lucy in his arms. It is said that babies are better judges of people than grown-up persons, Murta said, and I never saw a baby that would not go to Mr. Holmes and stay with him contentedly. They would go to him when they wouldn't come to me. He was remarkably fond of children. Often when we were traveling and there happened to be a baby in the car, he would say, "Go and see if they won't lend you that baby a little while." And when I brought it to him, he would play with it, forgetting everything else, until its mother called for it or I could see that she wanted it. He has often taken babies that were crying from their mothers, and it would hardly be any time until he had them sound asleep or playing as happily as little ones can. With Englewood booming, Holmes saw an opportunity. Ever since acquiring Holton's drugstore, he had been interested in the undeveloped land across the street. After a few inquiries, he learned that it was owned by a woman in New York. In the summer of 1888, he bought the land and, thinking ahead, registered the deed under a false name, H.S. Campbell. Soon afterward, he began jotting notes and sketching features for a building he planned to erect on the lot. He did not consult an architect, although a fine one, a Scotsman named A.A. Fraser, had an office in the building that housed Holton's store. To hire an architect would have meant revealing the true character of the structure that suddenly had lodged itself in his imagination. The building's broad design and its function had come to him all at once, like a blueprint pulled from a drawer. He wanted retail shops on the first floor to generate income and allow him to employ as many women as possible. Apartments would fill the second and third. His personal flat and a large office would occupy the second floor corner overlooking the intersection of 63rd and Wallace. These were the basics. It was the details of the building that gave him the most pleasure. He sketched a wooden chute that would descend from a secret location on the second floor all the way to the basement. He planned to coat the chute with axle grease. He envisioned a room next to his office fitted with a large walk-in vault with airtight seams and asbestos-coated iron walls. A gas jet embedded in one wall would be controlled from his closet, as would other gas jets installed in apartments throughout the building. There would be a large basement with hidden chambers and a sub-basement for the permanent storage of sensitive material. As Holmes dreamed and sketched, the features of his building became more elaborate and satisfying. Yet this was only the dream phase. He could hardly imagine the pleasure that would fill his days when the building was done and flesh-and-blood women moved among its features. As always, the thought aroused him. Constructing the building, he knew, would be no small challenge. He devised a strategy that he believed would not only allay suspicions, but also reduce the costs of construction. He placed newspaper advertisements for carpenters and laborers, and soon workers with teams of horses began excavating the land. The resulting hole evoked a giant grave and exuded the same musty chill, but this was not unwelcome, for it provided workers with relief from the intensifying summer heat. The men had difficulty with the soil. The top few feet were easy to manage, but below this the earth became sandy and wet. The sides of the pit had to be shored with timber. The walls bled water. A later report by a Chicago building inspector noted, "There is an uneven settlement of foundations, in some places as much as 4 inches in a span of 20 feet." Bricklayers set the foundation and laid the exterior walls, while carpenters erected the interior frame. The street resonated with the wheeze of handsaws. Holmes cast himself as a demanding contractor. As workers came to him for their wages, he berated them for doing shoddy work and refused to pay them, even if the work was perfect. They quit, or he fired them. He recruited others to replace them and treated these workers the same way. Construction proceeded slowly, but at a fraction of the proper cost. The high rate of turnover had the corollary benefit of keeping to a minimum the number of individuals who understood the building's secrets. A worker might be ordered to perform a certain task, for example, to install the gas nozzle inside the big walk-in vault, but in the narrow context within which the worker functioned, the assignment could seem reasonable, or at worst, merely eccentric. Even so, a bricklayer named George Bowman found the experience of working for Holmes somewhat chilling. "I don't know what to make of Holmes," Bowman said. "I hadn't been working for him but 2 days before he came around and asked me if I didn't think it pretty hard work, this bricklaying. He asked me if I wouldn't like to make money easier than that, and of course I told him yes. A few days after, he came over to me and, pointing down to the basement, said, 'You see that man down there? Well, that's my brother-in-law, and he has got no love for me, neither have I for him. Now, it would be the easiest matter for you to drop a stone on that fellow's head while you're at work, and I'll give you $50 if you do.'" What made the incident particularly frightening was Holmes's manner as he made the offer. "About the same manner one would expect from a friend who was asking you the most trivial question," Bowman said. Whether Holmes truly meant for Bowman to kill the man cannot be known. It would have been wholly within character for Holmes to have first persuaded the brother-in-law to take out a life insurance policy with Holmes as beneficiary. It was possible, too, that Holmes was merely testing Bowman to determine how useful he might be in the future. If so, it was a test that Bowman failed. "I was so badly scared I didn't know what to say or do," Bowman said. "But I didn't drop the stone, and got out of the place soon after." Three men did meet Holmes's standard of trustworthiness. Each worked for him throughout the period of construction, and continued to associate with him after the building was completed. One was Charles Chapel, a machinist who lived near Cook County Hospital. He first worked for Holmes as a common laborer, but soon proved to possess a talent that Holmes found particularly valuable. Another was Patrick Quinlan, who lived at 47th and Morgan in Englewood until he moved into Holmes's building as its caretaker. He was a small, twitchy man in his late 30s, with light curly hair and a sandy mustache. The third and most important was Benjamin Pitetzel, a carpenter, who joined Holmes in November 1889. He replaced a worker named Robert Latimer, who had quit to take over as gatekeeper at the rail intersection in front of Holmes's drugstore. At first, Latimer said, Pitetzel took care of the horses involved in the construction of Holmes's building, but later became his all-around assistant. Holmes and Pitetzel seemed to have a close relationship, close enough at least for Holmes to do Pitetzel a costly favor. Pitetzel was arrested in Indiana for attempting to pass forged checks. Holmes posted bail and forfeited the amount when Pitetzel, as planned, failed to return for trial. Pitetzel had smooth features and a sharp, well-defined chin. He might have been handsome if not for a certain hungry gauntness and the way the lids of his eyes cloaked the top of each iris. "In a general way," Holmes said, "I should describe him a man nearly 6 feet high, at least 5 feet 10 inches, always thin in flesh and weighing from 145 to 155 pounds, having very black and somewhat coarse hair, very thick, with no tendency to baldness. His mustache was a much lighter color, and I think of a red tinge, though I have seen him have it colored black at times, which gave him quite a different appearance." Pitetzel was plagued with various maladies: sore knees from the installation of one too many floors, a wart on his neck that kept him from wearing a stiff collar, and teeth so painful that at one point he had to suspend his work for Holmes. Despite being a chronic alcoholic, he was, in the appraisal of one doctor, a man of fine physique. Pititzel was married to Carrie Canning of Galva, Illinois, and the father of a fast-increasing number of children. Photographs of the children show a sweet, if sober, bunch, who seem ready in a moment's notice to swing into action with brooms and dishcloths. The couple's first daughter, Desi, had been born out of wedlock, an event entirely within the realm of what Pitizil's parents had come to expect of their son. In a last plea for Pitizil to take a more righteous path, his father wrote, "Come with me, and I will do thee good, is the Savior's command. Will you go? I will take that wicked nature out of you, and I will wash from you all stains, and I will be a father to you, and you shall be a son and an heir." The pain in his father's words was palpable. "I love you," he wrote, "although you have gone far astray." Alice, the second child, was born soon after the marriage. Another daughter and three sons followed, although one boy died of diphtheria shortly after birth. Three of the children, Alice, Nellie, and Howard, would become so well known throughout America that headline writers would refer to them by their first names alone, confident that even the most remote reader understood exactly who they were. Pitizil, too, would achieve a certain fame because of Holmes. Pitizil was his tool, a district attorney said. His creature. Construction of Holmes's building occurred in ragged stages and more or less halted each winter at the close of what workers called the building season. Although Holmes had read how architects in the loop were using techniques that allowed construction year-round, eventually much would be made of the fact that Holmes had erected his building during the same period in which Jack the Ripper, thousands of miles away, began his killings. The first of Jack's murders occurred August 31, 1888, the second a week later. Both victims were prostitutes, both had their throats cut, but there was more. After the second killing, a report in the British medical journal, The Lancet, concluded, "Obviously the work was that of an expert, or one at least who had such knowledge of anatomical or pathological examinations as to be enabled to secure the pelvic organs with one sweep of the knife." Police had no suspects and no real clues, but a London news service did receive a letter from someone claiming to be the killer. The writer signed it Jack the Ripper. Two of London's top detectives believed the letter to be a fake, written by a newspaper reporter to help keep the story alive. But the letter had an unintended effect. It compelled the real Whitechapel murderer to send off a note of his own. First, however, he took two more victims in a single night. Just as before, these women were prostitutes. He cut the throat of the first, but apparently was interrupted before he could pursue his other explorations. Moments later, he got the opportunity when he encountered Catherine Eddowes. This time he removed and kept a kidney. 2 weeks later, he mailed a package to one George Lusk, head of a vigilante group formed to hunt him down. The killer enclosed a letter and a portion of Eddowes' kidney. He claimed to have eaten the rest. He did not call himself Jack, but ended the letter with a taunt. "Catch me when you can, Mr. Lusk." The Ripper struck for the last time on the night of November 9, 1888. He met a prostitute named Mary Kelly and allowed her to bring him back to her rooms, where he slashed her throat in a Van Gogh stroke that nearly removed her head from her spine. This time, secure within walls, he made a more leisurely excursion into flesh and viscera. Over the next few hours, he carved off her breasts and placed these on a table along with her nose. He slashed her from throat to pubis, skinned her thighs, removed her internal organs, and arranged them in a pile between her feet. He cut off a hand, which he then thrust into her bisected abdomen. Kelly had been 3 months pregnant at the time. Abruptly, the murders stopped, as if that tryst with Mary Kelly had sated the killer's need at last. 5 confirmed victims, only 5, and Jack the Ripper became the embodiment forever of pure evil. Every Chicago resident who could read devoured these reports from abroad, but none with quite so much intensity as Dr. H. H. Holmes. On June 29, 1889, when Holmes's building was half completed, Chicago annexed Englewood and soon afterward established a new police precinct, the 10th 2nd Division, at 63rd and Wentworth, 7 blocks from Holmes's pharmacy. Soon, patrolmen under the command of Captain Horace Elliott began making regular walks past the store, where, in accord with custom, they stopped to chat with the young and personable owner. Periodically, the officers ambled across the street to watch construction of the new building. Englewood already had a number of substantial structures, including the YMCA, Normal School, and lavish Timmerman Opera House, now nearing completion at 63rd and Stewart. But the village still had a lot of open terrain, and any building destined to occupy an entire block was a topic of conversation. Construction took another year, with the usual hiatus for winter. By May 1890, the building was largely done. The second floor had 6 corridors, 35 rooms, and 51 doors. The third, another 36 rooms. The building's first floor had space for 5 retail stores, the best of which was a large and inviting corner shop on the intersection of 63rd and Wallace. 1 month after moving into his building, Holmes sold the former Holton drugstore and assured the buyer that he would face little competition. To the buyer's chagrin, Holmes promptly opened a new drugstore just across the street in his own corner shop. Holmes installed a variety of other businesses in his remaining first-floor stores, including a barber shop and restaurant. City Directory is also listed at Holmes's address, the office of a doctor named Henry D. Mann, possibly a Holmes alias, and the headquarters of the Warner Glass Bending Company, a company Holmes formed ostensibly to enter the booming new business of making and shaping the large sheets of plate glass suddenly in so much demand. Holmes equipped his shops with furniture and fixtures that he bought on credit. He had no intention of paying his debts, and was confident he could evade prosecution through guile and charm. When creditors came by demanding to see the owner of the building, Holmes referred them happily to the fictive H. S. Campbell. "He was the smoothest man I ever saw," said C. E. Davis, whom Holmes had hired to manage the drugstore's jewelry counter. "Creditors," Davis said, "would come here raging and calling him all the names imaginable, and he would smile and talk to them and set up the cigars and drinks and send them away seemingly his friends for life. I never saw him angry. You couldn't have trouble with him if you tried." Davis gestured toward the store. "If all the writs of mechanics' lien that have been levied on this structure were pasted on these 3 walls, the block would look like a mammoth circus billboard. But I never heard of a lien being collected. Holmes used to tell me he had a lawyer paid to keep him out of trouble, but it always seemed to me that it was the courteous, audacious rascality of the fellow that pulled him through. One day he bought some furniture for his restaurant and moved it in, and that very evening the dealer came around to collect his bill or remove his goods. Holmes set up the drinks, took him to supper, bought him a cigar, and sent the man off laughing at a joke, with a promise to call the next week for his money. In 30 minutes after he took his car, Holmes had wagons in front loading up that furniture, and the dealer never got a cent. Holmes didn't go to jail either. He was the only man in the United States that could do what he did." Holmes had the money to pay his debts. Davis estimated that Holmes made $200,000 through his drugstore and other business ventures, most of which were fraudulent. Holmes attempted, for example, to sell investors a machine that turned water into natural gas. He secretly connected his prototype to city gas lines. He was always charming and cordial, but there were times when even these traits failed to put his business associates at ease. A druggist named Erickson recalled how Holmes used to come into his store to buy chloroform, a potent but unpredictable anesthetic in use since the Civil War. "I sometimes sold him the drug 9 or 10 times a week, and each time it was in large quantities. I asked him what he used it for on several occasions, but he gave me very unsatisfactory answers. At last I refused to let him have any more unless he told me, as I pretended that I was afraid that he was not using it for any proper purpose." Holmes told Erickson he was using the chloroform for scientific experiments. Later, when Holmes returned for more chloroform, Erickson asked him how his experiments were coming. Holmes gave him a blank look and said he was not conducting any experiments. "I could never make him out," Erickson said. A woman named Strowers occasionally did Holmes's laundry. One day he offered to pay her $6,000 if she would acquire a $10,000 life insurance policy and name him beneficiary. When she asked why he would do such a thing, he explained that upon her death he'd make a profit of $4,000, but in the meantime she'd be able to spend her $6,000 in whatever manner she chose. To Mrs. Strowers this was a fortune, and all she had to do was sign a few documents. Holmes assured her it was all perfectly legal. She was healthy and expected to live a good long while. She was on the verge of accepting the offer when Holmes said to her, softly, "Don't be afraid of me," which terrified her. In November 1890, Holmes learned along with the rest of Chicago that the directors of the World's Columbian Exposition had at last reached a decision as to where to build the fair. To his delight, he read that the main site was to be Jackson Park, due east of his building at the lake end of 63rd, with exhibits also in downtown Chicago and Washington Park, and along the full length of Midway Boulevard. Holmes knew the parks from his bicycle journeys. Like most Americans, he had become caught up in the bicycle craze ignited by the advent of the safety bicycle, with its same-sized wheels and chain and sprocket drive. Unlike most Americans, however, Holmes sought also to capitalize on the craze by buying bicycles on credit, then reselling them without ever paying off the initial purchase. He himself wrote a Pope. The Exposition Company's decision raised a groundswell of greed throughout Chicago's South Side. An advertisement in the Tribune offered a 6-room house for sale at 41st and Ellis, a mile or so north of Jackson Park, and boasted that during the fair the new owner could expect to let 4 of the 6 rooms for nearly $1,000 a month, or about $30,000 in 21st century currency. Holmes' building and land were valuable to begin with, given Englewood's continued growth, but now his property seemed the equivalent of a seam of gold ore. An idea came to him for a way to mine that ore and also satisfy his other needs. He placed a new advertisement seeking more construction workers and once again called for the help of his loyal associates, Chapel, Quinlan, and Pitezel. Pilgrimage. On Monday evening, December 15th, 1890, a day noteworthy in Chicago for its extraordinary warmth and elsewhere for the gunshot death of Sitting Bull, Daniel Burnham stepped aboard a train bound for New York and what he knew would be the most crucial encounter of the Exposition Odyssey. He entered a bright green coach, one of George Pullman's palace cars, where the air hung with the stillness of a heavy tapestry. A bell clanged and continued clanging in a swinging rhythm as the train surged at grade level into the heart of the city at 20 miles an hour, despite the presence at arm's reach of grip cars, carriages, and pedestrians. Everyone on the street paused to watch as the train leapt past crossing gates, waving a raccoon's tail of white and black smoke. The train clicked by the Union Stockyard, doubly pungent in the day's strange warmth, and skirted sierras of black coal capped with grimy melting snow. Burnham treasured beauty, but saw none for miles and miles and miles, just coal, rust, and smoke in endless repetition until the train entered the prairie and everything seemed to go quiet. Darkness fell, leaving a false twilight of old snow. The exposition director's decision on where to locate the fair had caused a rapid acceleration of event that was encouraging but also unsettling, because suddenly the whole thing had become more real, its true magnitude more daunting. Immediately, the directors had ordered a rough plan of the fair to be delivered to them within 24 hours. John Root, guided by Burnham and Olmsted, had produced a drawing on a sheet of brown paper measuring 40 square feet, which the men delivered to the committee with a barbed aside to the effect that the designers of the Paris exposition had been able to spend a whole year thinking, planning, and sketching before reaching the same point. The drawing envisioned a mile-square plain on the lakeshore sculpted by dredges into a wonderland of lagoons and canals. Ultimately, the designers knew, the exposition would have hundreds of buildings, including one for each state of the Union and for many countries and industries. But on the drawing, they included only the 5 most important, each an immense palace sited around a central grand court. They also made room for a great tower to be built at one end of the court, although no one knew exactly who would build this tower or what it would look like, only that it would have to surpass Eiffel's tower in every way. The directors and their federal overseers, the National Commission, approved the plan with uncharacteristic speed. For outsiders, it was the sheer size of the exposition that made it seem such an impossible challenge. That the fair's grounds would be vast and its buildings colossal was something every Chicago resident took for granted. What mystified them was how anyone could expect to build the biggest thing ever constructed on American soil, far bigger than Roebling's Brooklyn Bridge, in so little time. Burnham knew, however, that the fair's size was just one element of the challenge. The gross features of the fair envisioned in the plan concealed 1 billion smaller obstacles that the public and most of the exposition's own directors had no idea existed. Burnham would have to build a railroad within the fairgrounds to transport steel, stone, and lumber to each construction site. He would have to manage the delivery of supplies, goods, mail, and all exhibit articles sent to the grounds by transcontinental shipping companies, foremost among them the Adams Express Company. He would need a police force and a fire department, a hospital and an ambulance service. And there would be horses, thousands of them. Something would have to be done about the tons of manure generated each day. Immediately after the brown paper plan received approval, Burnham requested authority to build at once cheap wooden quarters in Jackson Park for myself and Force, quarters in which he would live almost continuously for the next 3 years. This lodging quickly became known as the Shanty, though it had a large fireplace and an excellent wine cellar stocked by Burnham himself. With an appreciation of the power of perception that far outpaced his era, Burnham recognized that the tiniest details would shape the way people judged the exposition. His vigilance extended even to the design of the fair's official seal. "It may not occur to you how very important a matter this seal is," he wrote in a December 8, 1890 letter to George R. Davis, the fair's director general, its chief political officer. "It will be very largely distributed throughout foreign countries and is one of those trivial things by which these people will judge the artistic standard of the fair." All these, however, were mere distractions compared to the single most important task on Burnham's roster, the selection of architects to design the fair's major buildings. He and John Root had considered designing the whole exposition themselves, and indeed their peers jealously expected they would do so. Harriet Monroe, Root's sister-in-law, recalled how one evening Root came home cut to the quick because an architect whom he had considered a friend had apparently refused to recognize Mr. Burnham when they met at a club. Root grumbled, "I suppose he thinks we are going to hog it all." He resolved that to preserve his credibility as supervising architect, a role in which he would be compelled to oversee the work of other exposition architects, he would not himself design any of the buildings. Burnham knew exactly whom he wanted to hire, but was less aware of how incendiary his selections would prove. He wanted the best architects America had to offer, not just for their talent, but also for how their affiliation instantly would shatter the persistent Eastern belief that Chicago would produce only a country fair. In December, though he lacked an official mandate to do so, Burnham secretly mailed inquiries to 5 men, feeling confident that I would carry my point. And indeed, soon afterward, the Fair's Grounds and Buildings Committee authorized him to invite the men to join the exposition. Unquestionably, they were 5 of the greatest architects America had produced, but of the 5, 3 were from the land of unclean beasts itself. George B. Post, Charles McKim, and Richard M. Hunt, the nation's most venerable architect. The others were Robert Peabody of Boston and Henry Van Brunt, Kansas City. None was from Chicago, even though the city took great pride in its architectural pioneers, in Sullivan, Adler, Jenney, Beeman, Cobb, and the others. Somehow, despite his powers of anticipation, Burnham failed to realize that Chicago might see his choices as betrayal. What troubled Burnham at the moment, as he rode in his Pullman compartment, was the fact that only one of his candidates, Van Brunt of Kansas City, had replied with any enthusiasm. The others expressed only a tepid willingness to meet once Burnham arrived in New York. Burnham had asked Olmsted to join him for the meeting, aware that in New York, Olmsted's reputation exerted a force like gravity, but Olmsted could not get away. Now Burnham faced the prospect of having to go alone to meet these legendary architects. One of them, Hunt, a man also of legendary irascibility. Why were they so unenthusiastic? How would they react to his attempts at persuasion? And if they declined, and word of their refusal became public, what then? The landscape outside his windows gave him little solace. As his train roared across Indiana, it overtook a cold front. Temperatures plunged. Strong gusts of wind buffeted the train, and ghostly verga of ice followed it through the night. There were things Burnham did not know. That soon after receiving his letter, the Eastern architects, Hunt, Post, Peabody, and McKim, had held a meeting of their own in the offices of McKim, Mead, and White in New York to discuss whether the fair would be anything more than a display of overfed cattle. During the meeting, Hunt, the architect Burnham most hoped to recruit, announced he would not participate. George Post persuaded him at least to hear what Burnham had to say, arguing that if Hunt stood down, the others would feel pressed to do likewise, for such was Hunt's influence. McKim had opened this meeting with a wandering talk about the fair and its prospects. Hunt cut him off. "McKim, damn your preambles. Get down to facts." In New York, the wind blew hard and harsh all week. On the Hudson, ice produced the earliest halt to navigation since 1880. Over breakfast at his hotel on Thursday morning, Burnham read with uneasiness about the failure of S. A. Keene and Company, a private bank in Chicago. It was one more sign of a gathering panic. Burnham met the Eastern architects Monday evening, December 22nd, at the Players Club for dinner. Their cheeks were red from the cold. They shook hands. Hunt, McKim, Post, and Peabody. Peabody, down from Boston for the meeting. Here they were, gathered at one table, the nation's foremost practitioners of what Goethe called frozen music. All were wealthy and at the peaks of their careers, but all also bore the scars of a 19th-century life, their pasts full of wrecked rail cars, fevers, and the premature deaths of loved ones. Especially Charles Follen McKim, Charming Charlie. He was bald, strong, ambidextrous, an expert skater and ballplayer. Deep, crinkly deltas at the corners of his eyes testified to his love of humor and his earthy, often deployed wit. On October 1, 1874, he had married a Boston socialite, Annie Bigelow, for her beauty and talent as a musician, but apparently for little else. She left him 4 years later and took their 3-year-old daughter back to Boston. He did not see the girl for the next 17 years. He married again on June 25, 1885, this time for love. Her name was Julia Appleton. On their honeymoon, he learned of the death of partner Stanford White's first child. A year and a half later, Julia died abruptly in their New York home. McKim wore their wedding ring on his left pinky and, in times of stress or sorrow, absent-mindedly touched its twin interlocking hearts. He did not remarry. The Eastern architects wore dark suits and crisp white collars. All had mustaches, some dark, some gray. Post was huge, the largest man in the room. Hunt was fierce, a frown in a suit, with a client list that included most of America's richest families. Every other mansion in Newport, Rhode Island, and along Fifth Avenue in New York seemed to have been designed by him. But he also had built the base for the Statue of Liberty and was a founder of the American Institute of Architects. All the men had one or more elements of shared background. Hunt, McKim, and Peabody each had studied at L'École des Beaux-Arts in Paris. Van Brunt and Post had studied under Hunt. Van Brunt had been Peabody's mentor. For Burnham, with his failed attempts at getting into Harvard and Yale and his lack of formal architectural training, sitting down to dinner with these men was like being a stranger at someone else's Thanksgiving. The men were cordial. Burnham described his vision of a fair larger and grander than the Paris Exposition. He played up the fact of Olmsted's participation. Both Olmsted and Hunt were hard at work on George Washington Vanderbilt's manor, Biltmore, near Asheville, North Carolina, and together had built the Vanderbilt family's mausoleum. But Hunt was skeptical and not shy about expressing his doubts. Why should he and the others interrupt their already full schedules to build temporary structures in a far-off city where they would have little control over the final product? Their skepticism shook Burnham. He was accustomed to the headlong civic energy of Chicago. He wished Olmsted and Root were beside him. Olmsted to counter Hunt, Root because of his wit, and because the other architects all knew him from his role as secretary of the American Institute of Architects. Ordinarily, it was in situations like this that Burnham could be most effective. To himself, and indeed to most of the world in general, he was always right, wrote Harriet Monroe. And by knowing this so securely, he built up the sheer power of personality which accomplished big things. But this night, he felt ill at ease, a choir boy among cardinals. He argued that Chicago's fair, unlike any other before it, would be primarily a monument to architecture. It would awaken the nation to the power of architecture to conjure beauty from stone and steel. Olmsted's plans alone would make the exposition unique, with lagoons, canals, and great lawns all set against the cobalt blue steppe of Lake Michigan. In exhibit space, he told them, the fair would be at least one-third larger than what the French had allotted in Paris. This was no mere dream, he said. Chicago had the resolve to make this exposition a reality, the same resolve that had made the city the second largest in America. And, he added, it had the money. The architect's questions became slightly less challenging, more practical. What kind of structures did he envision, and in what style? The issue of the Eiffel Tower arose. What could Chicago do to equal that? On this score, Burnham had no plan other than somehow to surpass Eiffel. Secretly, he was disappointed that the engineers of America had not yet stepped forward with some novel but feasible scheme to eclipse Eiffel's achievement. The architects worried that anyone who joined the fair would find himself in the grip of innumerable committees. Burnham guaranteed complete artistic independence. They wanted to know in detail how Olmsted felt about the sites selected for the fair, in particular about a central feature called the Wooded Island. Their insistence prompted Burnham to telegraph Olmsted immediately and urge him once again to come. Again, Olmsted demurred. One question came up repeatedly throughout the evening. Was there enough time? Burnham assured them that ample time remained, but that he had no illusions. The work had to start at once. He believed he had won them. As the evening ended, he asked, would they join? There was a pause. Burnham left New York the next morning on the North Shore Limited. Throughout the day, his train pushed through a landscape scoured by snow as a blizzard whitened the nation in a swath from the Atlantic to Minnesota. The storm destroyed buildings, broke trees, and killed a man in Beaverton, Ohio, but did not stop the Limited. While aboard the train, Burnham wrote a letter to Olmsted that contained a less than candid description of the meeting with the architects. They all approved the proposition to have them take hold of the artistic part of the main buildings. The general layout seemed to meet the hearty approval first of Mr. Hunt, then of the others, but they were desirous of knowing your views of the landscape on and about the island. Therefore, I telegraphed you urgently to come. They were very much disappointed, as was I, when it was found impossible to get you. The gentlemen are all to be here on the 10th of next month, and at that time they urgently request, as do I, that you will be here personally. I find that Mr. Hunt especially lays large stress upon your opinions in the entire matter. In fact, the evening had ended rather differently. At the Players Club, sips of cognac and exhalations of smoke had filled that last difficult pause. The dream was an appealing one, the architects agreed, and no one doubted Chicago's sincerity in imagining this fantasy precinct of lagoons and palaces. But the reality was something else entirely. The only real certainty was the disruption caused by long-distance travel and the myriad other difficulties inherent in building a complex structure far from home. Peabody did commit to the fair, but Hunt and the others did not. They said, as Burnham later revealed, they would think it over. They did, however, agree to come to the January 10th meeting in Chicago to confer again and examine the chosen ground. None of the architects had been to Jackson Park. In its raw state, Burnham knew it was not a setting likely to win anyone's heart. This time Olmsted had to be present. In the meantime, Root, too, would have to become involved in the courtship. The architects respected him, but were leery of his powers as supervising architect. It was critical that he go to New York. Outside, the sky was blank, the light pewter. Despite Pullman's vestibules, ice as fine as dust settled between coaches and filled Burnham's train with the tang of deep winter. Wind-felled trees appeared beside the rail bed. Daniel Burnham arrived in Chicago to find the city's architects and members of the exposition board outraged that he had gone outside the city, to New York of all godforsaken places, to court architects for the fair, that he had snubbed the likes of Adler, Sullivan, and Jenny. Sullivan saw it as a sign that Burnham did not truly believe Chicago had the talent to carry the fair by itself. Burnham had believed that he might best serve his country by placing all of the work exclusively with Eastern architects, Sullivan wrote. Solely, he averred, on account of their surpassing culture. The The chairman of the Grounds and Buildings Committee was Edward T. Jeffrey. With exquisite delicacy and tact, Sullivan said, Jeffrey, at a meeting of the committee, persuaded Daniel Come to Judgment to add the Western men to the list of his nominations. Hastily, Root and Burnham conferred and chose 5 Chicago firms to join the effort, among them Adler and Sullivan. Burnham visited each the next day. 4 of the 5 put aside their hurt feelings and accepted immediately. Only Adler and Sullivan resisted. Adler was sulking. I think he, Adler, had hoped to be in the position I was in, Burnham said. He was rather disgruntled and did not know. Now it was Root's turn to go to New York. He had to go anyway to attend a meeting of the directors of the American Institute of Architects, and planned afterward to take a train to Atlanta to inspect one of the firm's buildings. Root was in his office at the Rookery on the afternoon of New Year's Day, 1891, shortly before his departure, when an employee stopped by to see him. He said he was tired, the man recalled, and felt inclined to resign the secretaryship of the Institute. This was alarming, as he had never been heard to complain of too much work, and while it only indicated extreme physical exhaustion, and before he went home he became cheerful and hopeful again, it has its significance in the light of subsequent events. In New York, Root assured the architects again and again that he would do nothing to interfere with their designs. Despite his charm, the Chicago Inter-Ocean once called him another Chauncey M. Depew in postprandial wit and humor. He failed to arouse their enthusiasm and left New York for Atlanta, feeling the same degree of disappointment Burnham had felt 2 weeks earlier. His journey south did little to cheer him up. Harriet Monroe saw him upon his return to Chicago. He was depressed, she said, by the attitude of the Eastern men, whom he found singularly apathetic, utterly incredulous that any association of Western businessmen would give art a free hand in the manner he set forth. The dream was too extravagant ever to be realized, and they were extremely reluctant to undertake its realization against the hampering and tampering, the interferences petty and great, which they felt were certain to ensue. Root was tired and discouraged. He told Monroe he just could not get the men interested. He felt that this was the greatest opportunity ever offered to his profession in this country, and he could not make them appreciate it, she said. The architects did plan to come to Chicago for the January meeting, he told her, but reluctantly. Their hearts were not in it. On January 5, 1891, the Committee on Grounds and Buildings authorized Burnham to offer formal commissions to all 10 architects and pay each $10,000, equivalent today to about $300,000. It was a rich fee, considering that all Burnham wanted them to do was provide working drawings and make a few visits to Chicago. Burnham and Root would see to the construction of the buildings and manage the niggling details that typically haunted an architect's life. There would be no artistic interference. The Eastern men gave their tentative acceptance, but their concerns had not diminished, and they still had not seen Jackson Park. A hotel for the fair. Holmes's new idea was to turn his building into a hotel for visitors to the World's Columbian Exposition. No Palmer House or Richelieu, certainly, but just comfortable enough and cheap enough to lure a certain kind of clientele, and convincing enough to justify a large fire insurance policy. After the fair, he intended to burn the building to collect the insurance and, as a happy dividend, destroy whatever surplus material might remain in its hidden storage chambers, although ideally, given other disposal measures available to him, the building by then would contain nothing of an incriminating nature. The thing is, one never knew. In the most transcendent moments, it was easy to make mistakes and forget some little thing that a clever detective might eventually use to propel him to the gallows. Whether the Chicago police even possessed that kind of talent was open to question. The Pinkerton National Detective Agency was the more dangerous entity, but its operatives of late seemed to be spending most of their energy battling strikers at coal fields and steel mills and rail yards around the country. Again acting as his own architect, Holmes early in 1891 began planning the necessary modifications, and soon carpenters were at work on the second and third floors. Once again, Holmes's method of segregating tasks and firing workers was proving successful. Clearly, none of the workers had gone to the police. Patrolmen from the new Chicago Police Precinct House on Wentworth walked past Holmes's building each day. Far from being suspicious, the officers had become friendly, even protective. Holmes knew each by name. A cup of coffee, a free meal in his restaurant, a fine black cigar. Policemen valued these gestures of affinity and grace. Holmes was, however, beginning to feel mounting pressure from creditors, in particular from several furniture and bicycle dealers. He could still charm them and commiserate over their inability to locate the elusive deed holder, H.S. Campbell, but Holmes knew they soon would lose patience, and in fact was a bit surprised that they had not pursued him more forcefully than had been the case thus far. His techniques were too new, his skills too great, the men around him too naive, as if they had never before experienced a falsehood. For every business that now refused to sell him goods, there were a dozen more that fawned over him and accepted his notes endorsed by H.S. Campbell or secured by the assets of the Warner Glass Bending Company. When pressed, sensing that a particular creditor was on the verge of legal action, even violence, Holmes paid his bills in cash using money harvested from his own ventures, such as lease income from his apartments and stores, sales from his pharmacy, and the proceeds from his newest venture, a mail-order medicine company. In a parody of Aaron Montgomery Ward's fast-growing empire in central Chicago, Holmes had begun selling sham drugs that he guaranteed would cure alcoholism and baldness. He was always open to new financial opportunities, but especially now, since he knew that no matter how deftly he kept labor costs down, he still would have to pay for at least some of the transformation of his building. When Murta's great-uncle, Jonathan Belknap of Bigfoot Prairie, Illinois, came to Wilmette for a visit, that challenge suddenly seemed likely to resolve itself. Belknap was not a rich man, but he was well off. Holmes began appearing more frequently at the Wilmette house. He brought toys for Lucy, jewelry for Murta and her mother. He filled the house with love. Belknap had never met Holmes but knew all about his troubled marriage to Murta and was prepared to dislike the young doctor. On first meeting, he found Holmes far too smooth and self-assured for a man of so few years. He was struck, however, by how enthralled Murta seemed to be whenever Holmes was around, and how even Murta's mother, Belknap's niece by marriage, appeared to glow in Holmes's presence. After several more encounters, Belknap began to appreciate why Murta had fallen so thoroughly for the man. He was handsome and clean and dressed well, and spoke in fine sentences. His gaze was blue and forthright. In conversation, he listened with an intensity that was almost alarming, as if Belknap were the most fascinating man in the world, not just an elderly uncle visiting from Bigfoot Prairie. Belknap still did not like Holmes, but found his candor sufficiently disarming that when Holmes asked him to endorse a note for $2,500 to help cover the cost of a new house and Wilmette for himself and Murta, Belknap agreed. Holmes thanked him warmly. A new house, away from Murta's parents, might be all the couple needed to end their growing estrangement. Holmes promised to pay the money back as soon as his business affairs allowed. Holmes returned to Englewood and promptly forged Belknap's signature to a second note for the same amount, intending to use the proceeds for his hotel. On Holmes's next visit to Wilmette, he invited Belknap to visit Englewood for a tour of his building and of the newly chosen site for the World's Columbian Exposition. Although Belknap had read much about the World's Fair and did want to see its future home, he did not relish the idea of spending a full day with Holmes. Holmes was charming and gracious, but there was something about him that made Belknap uneasy. He could not have defined it. Indeed, for the next several decades, alienists and their successors would find themselves hard-pressed to describe with any precision what it was about men like Holmes that could cause them to seem so warm and ingratiating, but that could also telegraph the vague sense that some important element of humanness was missing. At first, alienists described this condition as moral insanity, and those who exhibited the disorder as moral imbeciles. They later adopted the term psychopath, first used in the lay press as early as 1885 in William Stead's Pall Mall Gazette, which described it as a new malady and stated, "Beside his own person and his own interests, nothing is sacred to the psychopath." Half a century later, in his path-breaking book, The Mask of Sanity, Dr. Hervey Cleckley described the prototypical psychopath as a subtly constructed reflex machine which can mimic the human personality perfectly. So perfect is his reproduction of a whole and normal man that no one who examines him in a clinical setting can point out in scientific or objective terms why or how he is not real. People exhibiting this purest form of the disorder would become known in the jargon of psychiatry as Cleckley psychopaths. When Belknap refused Holmes's offer, Holmes seemed to crumble with hurt and disappointment. A tour was necessary, Holmes pleaded, if only to bolster his own sense of honor and demonstrate to Belknap that he really was a man of means, and that Belknap's note was as secure an investment as any man could make. Murta, too, looked crestfallen. Belknap gave in. During the train journey to Englewood, Holmes pointed out landmarks. The skyscrapers of the city, the Chicago River, the stockyards. Belknap found the stench overpowering, but Holmes seemed not to notice it. The men exited the train at Englewood Station. The town was alive with movement. Trains rumbled past every few minutes. Horse-drawn streetcars moved east and west along 63rd, amid a dense traffic of carriages and drays. Everywhere Belknap looked, some building was under construction. Soon the level of construction would increase even more as entrepreneurs prepared to cash in on the expected crush of exposition visitors. Holmes described his own plans. He took Belknap on a tour of his pharmacy, with its marble countertops and glass containers filled with wildly colored solutions, then took him up to the second floor, where he introduced him to the building's caretaker, Patrick Quinlan. Holmes walked Belknap through the building's many corridors and described how the place would look as a hotel. Belknap found it bleak and strange, with passages that struck off in unexpected directions. Holmes asked Belknap if he would like to see the roof and the construction already underway. Belknap declined, claiming falsely that he was too old a man to climb that many steps. Holmes promised stirring views of Englewood, perhaps even a glimpse of Jackson Park off to the east, where the buildings of the fair soon would begin to rise. Again, Belknap resisted, this time with more force. Holmes tried a different approach. He invited Belknap to spend the night in his building. At first, Belknap declined this offer as well, but feeling perhaps that he had been overly rude in avoiding the roof, he relented. After nightfall, Holmes led Belknap to a room on the second floor. Gas lamps had been installed at haphazard intervals along the corridor, leaving pockets of gloom whose borders shivered as Belknap and Holmes moved past. The room was furnished and comfortable enough, and overlooked the street, which was still reassuringly busy. As far as Belknap could tell, he and Holmes were by now the only occupants of the building. "When I went to bed," Belknap said, "I carefully locked the door." Soon the street sounds receded, leaving only the rumble of trains and the hollow clip-clop of an occasional horse. Belknap had difficulty sleeping. He stared at the ceiling, which was bathed in the shifting light of the street lamps below his window. Hours passed. "Presently," Belknap said, "I heard my door tried, and then a key was slipped into the lock." Belknap called out, asking who was at the door. The noise stopped. He held his breath and listened, and heard the sound of feet moving down the hall. He was certain that initially two men had been outside his door, but now one of them had left. He called again. This time a voice answered. Belknap recognized it as belonging to Patrick Quinlan, the caretaker. Quinlan wanted to come in. "I refused to open the door," Belknap said. He insisted for a time and then went away. Belknap lay awake the rest of the night. Soon afterward, he discovered Holmes's forgery. Holmes apologized, claiming a dire need for money, and was so persuasive and abject that even Belknap felt mollified, although his distrust of Holmes persisted. Much later, Belknap realized why Holmes had wanted so badly to show him the building's roof. "If I'd gone," Belknap said, "the forgery probably wouldn't have been discovered, because I wouldn't have been around to discover it." "But I didn't go," he said. "I'm afraid of heights." As carpenters and plasterers worked on his building, Holmes turned his attention to the creation of an important accessory. He sketched a number of possible designs, relying perhaps on past observations of similar equipment, then settled on a configuration that seemed likely to work. A large rectangular box of fireproof brick about 8 feet deep, 3 feet high, and 3 feet wide, encased within a second box of the same material, with the space between them heated by flames from an oil burner. The inner box would serve as an elongated kiln. Although he had never built a kiln before, he believed his design would generate temperatures extreme enough to incinerate anything within. That the kiln also be able to destroy any odors emanating from the interior box was singularly important. He planned to install the kiln in the basement and hired a bricklayer named Joseph E. Berkler to do the job. He told him he intended to use the kiln to produce and bend plate glass for his Warner Glass Bending Company. At Holmes's instructions, Berkler added a number of components made of iron. He worked quickly, and soon the kiln was ready for its first test. Holmes ignited the burner. There was a satisfying whoosh. A wave of warmth rolled from the chamber to the far walls of the basement. The scent of partially combusted oil suffused the air. But the test was disappointing. The box did not generate as much heat as he had hoped. He adjusted the burner and tried again, but achieved little improvement. He used the city directory to locate a furnace company and requested an appointment with an experienced man. He identified himself as the founder of Warner Glass. If, for some reason, officials of the furnace company felt moved to verify that Warner Glass existed, all they had to do was check the 1890 Englewood directory to find the company's listing, with Holmes named as proprietor. The manager of the furnace company, his name was never made public, decided to attend the matter personally and met Holmes at his building. He found a young, good-looking man, almost delicate, who conveyed an air of confidence and prosperity. He had striking blue eyes. His building was on the gloomy side, the construction obviously below the standards of structures rising elsewhere on 63rd, but it was well located in a community that clearly was booming. For so young a man to own most of a city block was itself an accomplishment. The manager followed Holmes to his second-floor office, and there, in the pleasant cross breeze from the corner windows, studied Holmes's drawings of his kiln. Holmes explained that he could not obtain the necessary amount of heat. The manager asked to see the apparatus. "That wasn't necessary," Holmes said. He did not wish to trouble the manager, only to seek his advice, for which, of course, he would pay an appropriate fee. The furnace man insisted he could do nothing without actually examining the kiln. Holmes smiled. "Of course. If the manager did not mind spending the extra time, he would be glad to show it to him." Holmes led his visitor down two to the first floor, and from there down another, darker flight to the basement. They entered a large rectangular cavern that ran the entire length of the block, interrupted only by beams and posts. In the shadows stood vats and barrels and mounds of dark matter, possibly soil. A long, narrow table with a steel top stood under a series of unlit lamps, and two worn leather cases rested nearby. The cellar had the look of a mine, the smell of a surgeon's suite. The furnace man examined the kiln. He saw that it contained an inner chamber of fire brick constructed in a manner that kept flames from reaching the interior, and noted the clever addition of two openings in the top of the inner box that would allow the flow of gases from the box into the surrounding flames, where these gases would then be consumed. It was an interesting design and seemed likely to work, although he did observe to himself that the shape of the kiln seemed unsuited to the task of bending glass. The inner box was too small to admit the broad panes now appearing in storefronts throughout the city. Otherwise, he noticed nothing unusual and foresaw no difficulty improving the kiln's operation. He returned with a work crew. The man installed a more powerful burner, which, once ignited, heated the kiln to 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Holmes seemed pleased. Only later did the furnace man recognize that the kiln's peculiar shape and extreme heat made it ideal for another, very different application. In fact, he said, the general plan of the furnace was not unlike that of a crematory for dead bodies, and with the provision already described, there would be absolutely no odor from the furnace. But again, that was later. Holmes's absences from Wilmeet lengthened once again, although at regular intervals he sent Murda and his daughter enough money to keep them comfortable. He even insured the girl's life, since children, after all, were such fragile things and could be taken from the world in a heartbeat. His businesses were doing well. His mail-order company brought in a surprising amount of cash, and he began trying to find a way to capitalize on the latest medical rage, a cure for alcoholism invented by a physician named Keeley in Dwight, Illinois. The corner drugstore ran smoothly and profitably, although one woman in the neighborhood observed that he seemed to have difficulty retaining the young and typically attractive women he often hired as clerks. These clerks, as far as she could tell, had an unfortunate habit of departing without warning, sometimes even leaving their personal belongings in their rooms on the second floor. She saw such behavior as a troubling sign of the rising shiftlessness of the age. The work of turning Holmes's building into a hotel proceeded slowly, with the usual bouts of rancor and delay. Holmes left the task of finding replacement workers to his three helpers, Quinlan, Chapel, and Pititzel. They seemed to have little difficulty finding new men for each new opening. Thousands of workers laid off elsewhere had come to Chicago hoping for jobs building the fair, only to find that too many workers had gotten the same idea, thus leaving a large pool of men available for work. Any work, at any price. Holmes turned his attention to other, more pleasant distractions. Sheer fate had brought two new women into his life, one of them nearly 6 feet tall and possessed of a rapturous body. The other, her sister-in-law, a lovely young woman with black hair and exquisite dark eyes. That the tall one came equipped with a husband and daughter only enhanced her appeal. It made the situation infinitely more appealing. The landscape of regret. The Eastern Architects left New Jersey at 4:50 p.m., January 8, 1891, in Car 5, Section 6 of the North Shore Limited, which Hunt had reserved so that all the architects could travel together. Olmsted had come down from Boston the night before in order to join them. It was a bewitching moment. A gorgeous train rocketing through the winter landscape carrying five of history's greatest architects, all in the same car, gossiping, joking, drinking, smoking. Olmsted used the opportunity to describe in detail Jackson Park and the trials of dealing with the exposition's many layers of committees that for the moment seemed to have so much power. He respected Burnham for his candor, directness, and the air of leadership he exuded, and no doubt told the architects as much. That he spent a good deal of time asserting his own vision of the exposition's landscape is also beyond doubt, especially his belief that the wooded island should remain entirely free of conspicuous man-made structures. 2 hours before the train reached Chicago, during a brief stop, McKim received a cable notifying him that his mother, Sarah McKim, had died unexpectedly in her home at 78. The two had been very close. He left the group and caught a return train. The architects arrived in Chicago late Friday night and took carriages to the Wellington Hotel, where Burnham had arranged rooms for all. Van Brunt, arriving from Kansas City, joined them there. The next morning, they boarded carriages for the journey south to Jackson Park. Root, absent, was to return that day from Atlanta. The ride to the park took about an hour. It was one of those cold winter days, Burnham recalled. The sky was overcast with clouds and the lake covered with foam. At the park, the architects eased from the carriages, puffing blasts of steam into the frigid air. The wind picked up motes of sand which stung their cheeks and forced them to shield their eyes. They stumbled over the frozen ground, Hunt wincing from gout, cursing, disbelieving. Olmsted, his teeth inflamed, his night an ordeal of wakefulness, limping from his long-ago carriage accident. The lake was gray, darkening to a band of black at the horizon. The only color in the vicinity was the frost rouge on the men's cheeks and the blue of Burnham's and Olmsted's eyes. Olmsted watched for the architect's reactions. Now and then he and Burnham caught each other's glances. The architects were stunned. They gazed, Burnham said, with a feeling almost of despair. Jackson Park was 1 square mile of desolation, mostly treeless, save for pockets of various kinds of oak, burr, pin, black, and scarlet, rising from a tangled undergrowth of elder, wild plum, and willow. In the most exposed portions there was only sand, tufted with marine and prairie grasses. One writer called the park remote and repulsive, another a sandy waste of unredeemed and desert land. It was ugly, a landscape of last resort. Olmsted himself had said of Jackson Park, if a search had been made for the least park-like ground within miles of the city, nothing better meeting the requirement could have been found. In fact, the sight was even worse than it appeared to the eye. Many of the oaks were dead. Given the season, the dead were hard to distinguish from the living. The root systems of others were badly damaged. Test borings showed the earth within the park consisted of a top layer of black soil about 1 foot thick, followed by 2 feet of sand, then 11 feet of sand, so saturated with water, Burnham wrote, it became almost like quicksand and was often given this name. The Chicago men understood the challenge this soil presented. The New York men, accustomed to bedrock, did not. The park's gravest flaw, at least from Olmsted's perspective, was that its shoreline was subject to dramatic annual changes in the level of the lake, perhaps as much as 4 feet. Such fluctuations, Olmsted recognized, would greatly increase the difficulty of planting the banks and shores. If the water level fell, visitors to the fair would be treated to an offensive band of bare earth at the waterline. If it rose too high, the water would submerge and kill shore plantings. The architects climbed back into their carriages. They drove toward the lake over the park's rough roads at the pace of a funeral cortege, and with equal gloom. Burnham wrote, a feeling of discouragement allied to hopelessness came over those who then first realized the extent and magnitude of the proposed undertaking, and appreciated the inexorable conditions of a time limitation to the work. 21 months later was the day fixed by Act of Congress for the dedication of the buildings, and in the short space of 27 1/2 months, or on May 1, 1893, the entire work of construction must be finished, the landscape perfected, and the exhibits installed. At the lake, they again left their carriages. Peabody of Boston climbed atop a pier. He turned to Burnham. "Do you mean to say that you really propose opening a fair here by 93? "Yes," Burnham said. "We intend to." Peabody said, "It can't be done." Burnham looked at him. "That point is settled," he said. But even he did not and could not grasp what truly lay ahead. Root returned to Chicago while the architects were in Jackson Park. It was his 41st birthday. He went directly from the train station to the rookery. He went down to the office in a gay humor, Harriet Monroe said, and that very day received a commission for a large commercial building. But that afternoon, draftsman Paul Sterrett encountered Root in one of the rookery's elevators, looking ill. His good spirits had fled. He complained again of being tired. The architects returned from their tour discouraged and full of regret. They gathered again in the firm's library, where Root, suddenly revitalized, now joined them. He was gracious, funny, warm. If anyone could sway these men and ignite their passion, Burnham knew, Root was the one. Root invited the outside men to come to his house on Astor Place the next day, Sunday, for high tea, then went home, at last, to greet his children and his wife, Dora, who, according to Harriet Monroe, was in bed, ill almost unto death, from a recent miscarriage. Root told Dora of his weariness and suggested that in the coming summer they should escape somewhere for a long rest. The last months had been full of frustration and long nights of work and travel. He was exhausted. The trip south had done nothing to ease his stress. He looked forward to the end of the week, to January 15th, when the architects would conclude their conference and go home. "After the 15th," he told his wife, "I shall not be so busy." The Eastern and Chicago architects reconvened that night at the University Club for a dinner in their honor, hosted by the Fair's Grounds and Buildings Committee. Root was too tired to attend. Clearly, the dinner was a weapon meant to ignite enthusiasm and show the Easterners that Chicago fully intended to follow through on its grand boasts about the exposition. It was the first in a sequence of impossibly rich and voluminous banquets whose menus raised the question of whether any of the city's leading men could possibly have a functional artery. As the men arrived, reporters intercepted them. The architects were gracious, but close-mouthed. They sat at a large T-shaped table with Lyman Gage, president of the exposition, at the center of the topmost table, Hunt on his right, Olmsted on his left. Bundles of carnations and pink and red roses transformed the tables into cutting beds. A boutonniere rested beside each plate. Everyone wore tuxedos. There was not a woman in sight. At precisely 8 p.m., Gage took Hunt and Olmsted by the arm and led the way from the club's reception room to the banquet hall. Oysters. A glass or two of Montrachet. Consommé of green turtle. Amontillado. Broiled shad à la maréchale. Cucumbers. Potatoes à la duchesse. Filet mignon à la Rossini. Château Lafitte and Renard Brut. Fonds d'entrechaux farci. Pommery sec. Sorbet au kirsch. Cigarettes. Woodcock on toast. Asparagus sala. Ices. Canton ginger. Cheeses. Pont-l'Evêque. Roquefort. Coffee. Liqueurs. Madeira, 1815. Cigars. Gage spoke first. He offered a rousing oration on the brilliance of the future exposition and the need now for the great men in the banquet hall to think first of the fair, last of themselves. That only through the subordination of self would the exposition succeed. The applause was warm and enthusiastic. Burnham spoke next. He describes his own vision of the fair and Chicago's resolve to make that vision real. He too urged teamwork and self-sacrifice. "Gentlemen," he said, "1893 will be the third great date in our country's history. On the two others, 1776 and 1861, all true Americans served, and so now I ask you to serve again." This time, the room erupted. The men left the banquet hall that night united like soldiers in a campaign, Burnham said. It was the Chicagoans, however, who did all the marching. At Root's house the next day, Harriet Monroe met the Eastern architects and came away shaken. "In talking with them, I was amazed at their listless and hopeless attitude," she said. "Beautiful effects were scarcely to be expected in buildings so enormous and so cheaply constructed. The level of monotony of ground surfaces in Chicago made effective grouping practically impossible. The time for preparation and construction was too short." These and other criticisms indicated a general feeling of disparagement. At tea's end, Root escorted the visitors to their carriages. It was dark and bitterly cold. A sharp wind scythed along Astor Place. Much was made in retrospect of the fact that Root, in evening dress, charged into the rock-cold night without first putting on a coat. Vanishing Point. After years spent drifting from town to town and job to job, a young jeweler named Icilius Connor, he preferred the nickname Ned, moved to Chicago with his wife Julia and their 8-year-old daughter Pearl, and quickly found that Chicago was indeed a city of opportunity. At the start of 1891, Ned found himself managing a jewelry counter that occupied one wall of a thriving drugstore on the city's south side, at 63rd and Wallace. For once in Ned's adult life, the future gleamed. The owner of the drugstore, though very young, was prosperous and dynamic, truly a man of the age, and seemed destined for even greater success, given that the World's Columbian Exposition was to be built just a short streetcar ride east at the end of 63rd. There was talk, too, that a newly elevated rail line, nicknamed the Alley L for the way its trestles roofed city alleys, would be extended eastward along 63rd directly to Jackson Park, thus providing visitors with another means of reaching the future fair. Already traffic on the street had increased sharply, as each day hundreds of citizens drove their carriages to the park to see the chosen site. Not that there was much to see. Ned and Julia had found the park an ugly, desolate place of sandy ridges and half-dead oaks, although Pearl had enjoyed trying to catch tadpoles in its pools of stagnant water. That anything wonderful could rise on that ground seemed beyond possibility, although Ned, like most new visitors to Chicago, was willing to concede that the city was a place unlike any he had encountered. If any city could make good on the elaborate boasts circulated thus far, Chicago was the one. Ned's new employer, Dr. H. H. Holmes, seemed a perfect example of what everyone called the Chicago spirit. To be so young, yet own a restaurant, barbershop, and drugstore, and the block-long building that housed them, would be incredible in any other place of Ned's experience. Here, it seemed an ordinary accomplishment. The Connors lived in a flat on the second floor of the building, near Dr. Holmes's own suite of rooms. It was not the brightest, most cheerful apartment, but it was warm and close to work, and the building's location allowed Pearl to attend the famous Cook County Normal School a few blocks away. Moreover, Holmes offered to employ Julia as a clerk in the drugstore and to train her to keep his books. And later, when Ned's 18-year-old sister Gertrude moved to Chicago, Holmes asked to hire her as well, to manage his new mail-order medicine company. With three incomes, the family might soon be able to afford a house of their own, perhaps on one of the wide Macadam streets of Englewood. Certainly they'd be able to afford bicycles and trips to Timmerman's Theater down the street. One thing did make Ned uneasy, however. Holmes seemed inordinately attentive to Gertie and Julia. On one level, this was natural and something to which Ned had become accustomed, for both women were great beauties. Gertie slim and dark, Julia tall and felicitously proportioned. It was clear to Ned, clear in fact from the first moment, that Holmes was a man who liked women, and whom women liked in return. Lovely young women seemed drawn to the drugstore. When Ned tried to help them, they were remote and uninterested. Their manner changed markedly if Holmes happened then to enter the store. Always a plain man, Ned now seemed to become part of the background, a bystander to his own life. Only his daughter Pearl was as attentive to him as always. Ned watched with alarm as Holmes flattered Gertie and Julia with smiles and gifts and treacly praise, especially Gertie, and how the women glowed in response. When Holmes left them, they appeared crestfallen, their demeanor suddenly brittle and snappish. Even more disconcerting was the change in how customers responded to Ned himself. It was not what they said, rather what they carried in their eyes. Something like sympathy, even pity. One night during this period, Holmes asked Ned a favor. He led him to the big vault and stepped inside, then told Ned to close the door and listen for the sound of his shouting. "I shut the door and put my ear to the crack," Ned recalled, "but could hear only a faint sound." Ned opened the door and Holmes stepped out. Now Holmes asked Ned if he would go inside and try shouting so that Holmes could hear for himself how little sound escaped. Ned did so, but got back out the instant Holmes reopened the door. "I didn't like that kind of business," he said. Why anyone would even want a soundproof vault was a question that apparently did not occur to him. For the police, there were warnings of a different sort. Letters from parents, visits from detectives hired by parents, but these were lost in the chaos. Vanishment seemed a Chicago pastime. There were too many disappearances in all parts of the city to investigate properly, and too many forces tending to impede the detection of patterns. Patrolmen, many of them, were barely competent, appointed solely at the direction of ward bosses. Detectives were few, their resources and skills minimal. Class obscured their vision. Ordinary vanishings. Polish girls, stockyard boys, Italian laborers, Negro women, merited little effort. Only the disappearance of moneyed souls drew a forceful response, and even then there was little detectives could do other than send telegrams to other cities and periodically check the morgue for each day's collection of unidentified men, women, and children. At one point, half the city's detective force was involved in investigating disappearances, prompting the chief of the city's central detective unit to announce he was considering the formation of a separate bureau, a mysterious disappearances department. Women and men vanished in equal proportion. Fanny Moore, a young visitor from Memphis, failed to return to the home where she was boarding and was never seen again. J.W. Heiliman left work one day, caught a suburban train, and vanished, the Tribune said, as completely as though swallowed by the earth. The women were presumed to have been ravished, the men robbed, their corpses plunged into the turgid waters of the Chicago River or the alleys of Halstead and the levee and that hard stretch of Clark between Polk and Taylor, known to veteran officers as Cheyenne. Found bodies went to the morgue. If unclaimed, they traveled next to the dissection amphitheater at Rush Medical College or perhaps Cook County Hospital, and from there to the articulation laboratory for the delicate task of picking flesh and connective tissue from the bones and skull, washing all with bleach, and remounting same for the subsequent use of doctors, anatomy museums, and the occasional private collector of scientific novelties. The hair was sold for wigs, the clothing given to settlement houses. As was the case at the Union Stockyards, Chicago wasted nothing. Alone. The Eastern and Chicago architects met again on Monday morning, January 12th, in Burnham and Root's library on the top floor of the Rookery. Root was absent. William R. Meade had come from New York to stand in for his grieving partner, McKim. As the men waited for everyone to arrive, the visitors from time to time would drift to the library's east-facing windows and stare out at the vastness of Lake Michigan. The light entering the room was preternaturally intense, carrying with it the surplus radiance of the lake and its frozen shore. Burnham rose to offer the man a formal welcome, but he did not seem at ease. He was aware of the lingering reticence of the Eastern men and seemed hell-bent on winning them with flattery that verged on unction, a tactic that Lewis Sullivan had known Burnham to deploy with great effect. Himself not especially susceptible to flattery except in a sentimental way, he soon learned its efficacy when plastered thick on big businessmen, Sullivan wrote. Lewis saw it done repeatedly and at first was amazed at Burnham's effrontery, only to be more amazingly amazed at the drooling of the recipient. The method was crude, but it worked. Said Sullivan, it soon became noticeable that he was progressively and grossly apologizing to the Eastern men for the presence of their benighted brethren of the West. Hunt noticed it too. Hell, he snapped, we haven't come here on a missionary expedition. Let's get to work. Murmurs of agreement rose through the room. Adler was cheered. Sullivan smirked. Olmsted watched, deadpan, as he listened to a roaring in his ears that would not subside. Hunt grimaced. The trip from New York and the excursion to Jackson Park had worsened his gout. Hunt's interjection startled Burnham. It brought back in a rush the hurt of the great dual snub by the East, his rejection by Harvard and Yale. But the remark and the obvious support it garnered in the room also caused Burnham to shift focus to the work at hand. As Sullivan saw it, Burnham came out of his somnambulistic vagary and joined in. He was keen enough to understand that Uncle Dick, meaning Hunt, had done him a needed favor. Burnham told the men that henceforth they would serve as the fair's board of architects. He invited them to choose a chairman. They elected a Hunt. The natural dominance of the master again asserted itself without pretension, wrote Van Brunt, and we once again became his willing and happy pupils. For secretary they elected Sullivan, who most decidedly was not a happy pupil of Hunt's. To him, Hunt was the janissary of a dead vernacular. Burnham, too. Both men symbolized all that stood in the way of his own emerging ethos, that a building's function should express itself in its design, not merely that form should follow function, but that the function created or organized its form. To Sullivan, Hunt was merely a relic, Burnham something far more dangerous. In him, Sullivan saw a kindred capacity for obsession. Sullivan had come to see Chicago architecture as dominated by only two firms, Burnham and Root and Adler and Sullivan. In each firm was a man with a fixed, irrevocable purpose in life, for the sake of which he would bend or sacrifice all else, Sullivan wrote. Daniel Burnham was obsessed by the feudal idea of power. Lewis Sullivan was equally obsessed by the beneficent idea of democratic power. Sullivan admired both Root and Adler, but believed they functioned on a lesser plane. John Root was so self-indulgent that there was a risk he might never draw upon his underlying power. Adler was essentially a technician, an engineer, a conscientious administrator. Unquestionably, Adler lacked sufficient imagination. So, in a way, did John Root. That is to say, the imagination of the dreamer. In the dream imagination lay Burnham's strength and Lewis's passion. Shortly before noon, Burnham left the room to take a telephone call from Dora Root. She told him her husband had awakened with a bad cold and would not be able to attend the meeting. Several hours later, she called again. A doctor had come and diagnosed pneumonia. Root's spirits were good. He joked and sketched. "I haven't escaped sickness all my life to get off easily now," he told Harriet Monroe. "I knew when my turn came, it would be a tartar." The architects continued to meet, but without Burnham, who stayed beside his partner's bed except for occasional departures to help resolve issues back in the library, or to visit Hunt, whose gout had grown so painful he was confined to his room in the Wellington Hotel. Root joked with his nurses. At its regular Wednesday meeting, the Grounds and Buildings Committee passed a resolution wishing Root a speedy recovery. That day, Burnham wrote to a Chicago architect named W.W. Boyington. "Mr. Root is quite low, and there is uncertainty about his recovery, but still a chance for him." On Thursday, Root seemed to rally. Burnham again wrote to Boyington, "Am able this morning to give you a little better report. He has passed a pretty good night and is easier. While the danger is not over, we are hopeful." Enthusiasm among the architects rose. With Hunt still confined to his room, Post stood in as chairman. He and Van Brunt shuttled to and from Hunt's hotel. The architects approved the original brown paper plan fashioned by Burnham, Olmsted, and Root with few changes. They decided how big the main buildings should be and how they should be situated on the site. They chose a uniform style, neoclassical, meaning buildings would have columns and pediments and evoke the glories of ancient Rome. This was anathema to Sullivan, who abhorred derivative architecture, but during the meeting he made no objection. The architects also made what would prove to be one of the most important decisions of the fair, to set a uniform height, 60 feet, for the cornice of each of the palaces of the Court of Honor. A cornice was merely a horizontal decorative projection. Walls, roofs, domes, and arches could rise far higher, but by establishing this one point of commonality, the architects ensured a fundamental harmony among the fair's most imposing structures. At about 4 o'clock Thursday afternoon, Codman and Burnham drove to Root's house. Codman waited in the carriage as Burnham went inside. Burnham found Root struggling for breath. Throughout the day, Root had experienced strange dreams, including one that had come to him many times in the past of flying through the air. When Root saw Burnham, he said, "You won't leave me again, will you?" Burnham said no, but he did leave, to check on Root's wife, who was in a neighboring room. As Burnham talked with her, a relative also entered the room. She told them Root was dead. In his last moments, she said, he had run his fingers over his bedding as if playing the piano. "Do you hear that?" he whispered. "Isn't it wonderful? That's what I call music." The house settled into an eerie post-mortem quiet broken only by the hiss of gas lamps and the weary tick of clocks. Burnham paced the floor below. He did not know it, but he was being watched. Harriet Monroe's Aunt Nettie sat on a step high on the dark upper curve of the stairway that rose from Root's living room to the second floor. The woman listened as Burnham paced. A fire burned in the hearth behind him and cast large shadows on the opposing wall. "I have worked," Burnham said. "I have schemed and dreamed to make us the greatest architects in the world. I have made him see it and kept him at it, and now he dies. Damn, damn, damn." Root's death stunned Burnham, stunned Chicago. Burnham and Root had been partners and friends for 18 years. Each knew the other's thoughts. Each had come to rely on the other for his skills. Now, Root was gone. Outsiders wondered if Root's death might mean the death of the exposition. The newspapers were full of interviews in which the city's leading men described Root as the guiding force behind the fair, that without him the city could not hope to realize its dreams. The Tribune said Root was, easily, Chicago's most distinguished architect, if indeed he had his superior in the whole country. Edward Jeffrey, chairman of the Grounds and Buildings Committee, said, "There is no man in the profession of architects who has the genius and ability to take up the exposition work where Mr. Root left off." Burnham kept silent. He considered quitting the fair. Two forces warred within him: grief and a desire to cry out that he, Burnham, had been the engine driving the design of the fair, that he was the partner who had propelled the firm of Burnham and Root to greater and greater achievement. The Eastern architects departed on Saturday, January 17th. On Sunday, Burnham attended a memorial service for Root at Root's Astor Place house and his burial in Graceland Cemetery, a charming haven for the well-heeled dead a few miles north of the Loop. On Monday, he was back at his desk. He wrote 12 letters. Root's office next to his was silent, draped in bunting. Hothouse flowers perfumed the air. The challenge ahead looked more daunting than ever. On Tuesday, a large bank failed in Kansas City. The following Saturday, Lyman Gage announced he would quit as president of the fair effective April 1st to tend to his own bank. The fair's director general, George Davis, at first refused to believe it. "It's all nonsense," he snapped. "Gage has got to stay with us. We can't do without him." There was labor unrest. Just as Burnham had feared, union leaders began using the future fair as a vehicle for asserting such goals as the adoption of a minimum wage and an 8-hour day. There was the threat of fire and weather and disease. Already foreign editors were asking who would dare attend the exposition, given Chicago's notorious problems with sewage. No one had forgotten how in 1885 the city's fouled water had ignited an outbreak of cholera and typhoid that killed 10% of the city's population. Darker forces marshaled in the smoke. Somewhere in the heart of the city, a young Irish immigrant sank still more deeply into madness, the preamble to an act that would shock the nation and destroy what Burnham dreamed would be the single greatest moment of his life. Closer at hand, a far stranger creature raised his head in equally intent anticipation. "I was born with the devil in me," he wrote. "I could not help the fact that I was a murderer, no more than the poet can help the inspiration to sing." Part 2. An Awful Fight. Chicago, 1891 to 1893. Convocation. On Tuesday, February 24th, 1891, Burnham, Olmsted, Hunt, and the other architects gathered in the library on the top floor of the Rookery to present drawings of the fair's main structures to the Grounds and Buildings Committee. The architects met by themselves throughout the morning, with Hunt serving as chairman. His gout forced him to keep one leg on the table. Olmsted looked worn and gray, except for his eyes, which gleamed beneath his bald skull like marbles of lapis. A new man had joined the group, Augustus St. Gaudens, one of America's best-known sculptors, whom Charles McKim had invited to help evaluate the designs. The members of the Grounds and Buildings Committee arrived at 2 o'clock and filled the library with the scent of cigars and frosted wool. The light in the room was sallow, the sun already well into its descent. Wind thumped the windows. In the hearth at the north wall, a large fire cracked and lisped and flushed the room with a dry scirocco that caused frozen skin to tingle. At Hunt's brusque prodding, the architects got to work. One by one, they walked to the front of the room, unrolled their drawings, and displayed them upon the wall. Something had happened among the architects, and it became evident immediately, as though a new force had entered the room. They spoke, Burnham said, almost in whispers. Each building was more lovely, more elaborate than the last, and all were immense, fantastic things on a scale never before attempted. Hunt hobbled to the front and displayed his administration building, intended to be the most important at the fair and the portal through which most visitors would enter. Its center was an octagon topped by a dome that rose 275 feet from floor to peak, higher than the dome of the U.S. Capitol. The next structure presented was even bigger. If successfully erected, George B. Post's Manufacturing and Liberal Arts Building would be the largest building ever constructed and consume enough steel to build 2 Brooklyn bridges. All that space, moreover, was to be lit inside and out with electric lamps. 12 electric elevators would carry visitors to the building's upper reaches. 4 would rise through a central tower to an interior bridge 220 feet above the floor, which in turn would lead to an exterior promenade offering foot-tingling views of the distant Michigan shore. A panorama, as one guidebook later put it, such as never before has been accorded to mortals. Post proposed to top his building with a dome 450 feet high, which would have made the building not only the biggest in the world, but also the tallest. As Post looked around the room, he saw in the eyes of his peers great admiration, but also something else. A murmur passed among them. Such was this new level of cohesion among the architects that Post understood at once. The dome was too much. Not too tall to be built, simply too proud for its context. It would diminish Hunt's building, and in so doing, diminish Hunt, and disrupt the harmony of the other structures on the grand court. Without prodding, Post said quietly, "I don't think I shall advocate that dome. Probably I shall modify the building." There was unspoken but unanimous approval. Sullivan already had modified his own building at Burnham's suggestion. Originally, Burnham wanted Adler and Sullivan to design the fair's music hall, but partly out of a continued sense of having been wronged by Burnham, the partners had turned the project down. Burnham later offered them the transportation building, which they accepted. 2 weeks before the meeting, Burnham wrote to Sullivan and urged him to modify his design, to create 1 grand entrance toward the east and make this much richer than either of the others you had proposed. "I'm sure that the effect of your building will be much finer than by the old method of 2 entrances on this side, neither of which could be so fine and effective as the one central feature." Sullivan took the suggestion, but never acknowledged its prominence, even though that one great entrance eventually became the talk of the fair. All the architects, including Sullivan, seemed to have been captured by the same spell, although Sullivan later would disavow the moment. As each architect unrolled his drawings, the tension of feeling was almost painful, Burnham said. St. Gaudens, tall and lean and wearing a goatee, sat in a corner very still, as if he were a figure sculpted from wax. On every face, Burnham saw a quiet intentness. It was clear to him that now, finally, the architects understood that Chicago had been serious about its elaborate plans for the fair. Drawing after drawing was unrolled, Burnham said, and as the day passed, it was apparent that a picture had been forming in the minds of those present, a vision far more grand and beautiful than hitherto presented by the richest imagination. As the light began to fade, The architects lit the library's gas jets, which hissed like mildly perturbed cats. From the street below, the top floor of the rookery seemed aflame with the shifting light of the jets and the fire in a great hearth. The room was still as death, Burnham said, save for the low voice of the speaker commenting on his design. It seemed as if a great magnet held everyone in its grasp. The last drawing went up. For a few moments afterward, the silence continued. Lyman Gage, still president of the exposition, was first to move. He was a banker, tall, straight-backed, conservative in demeanor and dress, but he rose suddenly and walked to a window, trembling with emotion. "You are dreaming, gentlemen. Dreaming," he whispered. "I only hope that half the vision may be realized." Now St. Gaudens rose. He had been quiet all day. He rushed to Burnham and took his hands in his own. "I never expected to see such a moment," he said. "Look here, old fellow. Do you realize this has been the greatest meeting of artists since the 15th century?" Olmsted, too, sensed that something extraordinary had occurred, but the meeting also troubled him. First, it confirmed his growing concern that the architects were losing sight of the nature of the thing they were proposing to build. The shared vision expressed in their drawings struck him as being too sober and monumental. After all, this was a world's fair, and fairs should be fun. Aware of the architect's increasing emphasis on size, Olmsted shortly before the meeting had written to Burnham suggesting ways to enliven the grounds. He wanted the lagoons and canals strewn with waterfowl of all kinds and colors, and traversed continually by small boats. Not just any boats, however, becoming boats. The subject became an obsession for him. His broad view of what constituted landscape architecture included anything that grew, flew, floated, or otherwise entered the scenery he created. Roses produced dabs of red. Boats added intricacy and life. But it was crucial to choose the right kind of boat. He dreaded what would happen if the decision were left to one of the fair's many committees. He wanted Burnham to know his views from the start. "We should try to make the boating feature of the exposition a gay and lively one," he wrote. He loathed the clatter and smoke of steam launches. He wanted electric boats designed specifically for the park, with emphasis on graceful lines and silent operation. It was most important that these boats be constantly but quietly in motion, to provide diversion for the eye, peace for the ear. "What we shall want is a regular service of boats like that of an omnibus line in a city street," he wrote. He also envisioned a fleet of large birch bark canoes paddled by Indians in deerskin and feathers, and recommended that various foreign watercraft be moored in the fair's harbor. "I mean such as Malay proas, catamarans, Arab dhows, Chinese sandpans, Japanese pilot boats, Turkish caiques, Eskimos kayaks, Alaskan war canoes, the hooded boats of the Swiss lakes, and so on." A far more important outcome of the rookery meeting, however, was Olmsted's recognition that the architect's noble dreams magnified and complicated the already daunting challenge that faced him in Jackson Park. When he and Calvert Vaugh designed Central Park in New York, they planned for visual effects that would not be achieved for decades. Here he would have just 26 months to reshape the desolation of the park into a prairie Venice and plant its shores, islands, terraces, and walks with whatever it took to produce a landscape rich enough to satisfy his vision. What the architect's drawings had shown him, however, was that in reality he would have far fewer than 26 months. The portion of his work that most would shape how visitors appraised his landscape, the planting and grooming of the grounds immediately surrounding each building, could only be done after the major structures were completed and the grounds cleared of construction equipment, temporary tracks and roads, and other aesthetic impedimenta. Yet the palaces unveiled in the rookery were so immense, so detailed, their construction was likely to consume nearly all the remaining time, leaving little for him. Soon after the meeting, Olmsted composed a strategy for the transformation of Jackson Park. His 10-page memorandum captured the essence of all he had come to believe about the art of landscape architecture, and how it should strive to conjure effects greater than the mere sum of petals and leaves. He concentrated on the fair's central lagoon, which his dredges soon would begin carving from the Jackson Park shore. The dredges would leave an island at the center of the lagoon to be called simply the Wooded Island. The fair's main buildings would rise along the lagoon's outer banks. Olmsted saw this lagoon district as the most challenging portion of the fair. Just as the Grand Court was to be the architectural heart of the fair, so the central lagoon and Wooded Island were to constitute its landscape centerpiece. Above all, he wanted the exposition landscape to produce an aura of mysterious, poetic effect. Flowers were not to be used as an ordinary gardener would use them. Rather, every flower, shrub, and tree was to be deployed with an eye to how each would act upon the imagination. This was to be accomplished, Olmsted wrote, through the mingling intricately together of many forms of foliage, the alternation and complicated crossing of salient leaves and stalks of varying green tints in highlights with other leaves and stalks, behind and under them, and therefore less defined and more shaded, yet partly illumined by light reflected from the water. He hoped to provide visitors with a banquet of glimpses. The undersides of leaves sparkling with reflected light, flashes of brilliant color between fronds of tall grass waving in the breeze. Nowhere, he wrote, should there be a display of flowers demanding attention as such. Rather, the flowers to be used for the purpose should have the effect of flecks and glimmers of bright color imperfectly breaking through the general greenery. Anything approaching a gorgeous, garish, or gaudy display of flowers is to be avoided. Sedges and ferns and graceful bulrush would be planted on the banks of the Wooded Island to conjure density and intricacy, and to slightly screen, without hiding, flowers otherwise likely to be too obtrusive. He envisioned large patches of cattails broken by bulrush, iris, and flag, and pocketed with blooming plants such as flame-red cardinal flower and yellow creeping buttercup, planted, if necessary, on slightly raised mounds, so as to be just visible among the swaying green spires in the foreground. On the far shore, below the formal terraces of the buildings, he planned to position fragrant plants such as honeysuckle and summer sweet, so that their perfume would rise into the nostrils of visitors pausing on the terraces to view the island and the lagoon. The overall effect, he wrote, is thus to be in some degree of the character of a theatrical scene, to occupy the exposition stage for a single summer. It was one thing to visualize all this on paper, another to execute it. Olmsted was nearly 70, his mouth aflame, his head roaring, each night a desert of wakefulness. Even without the fair, he faced an intimidating portfolio of works in progress, chief among them the grounds of Biltmore, the Vanderbilt estate in North Carolina. If everything went perfectly, if his health did not degrade any further, if the weather held, if Burnham completed the other buildings on time, if strikes did not destroy the fair, if the many committees and directors, which Olmsted called that army our hundreds of masters, learned to leave Burnham alone, Olmsted might be able to complete his task on time. A writer for Engineering Magazine asked the question no one had raised at the rookery. How is it possible that this vast amount of construction, greatly exceeding that of the Paris exhibition of 1889, will be ready in 2 years? For Burnham, too, the meeting in the rookery had produced a heightened awareness of how little time remained. Everything seemed to take longer than it should, and nothing went smoothly. The first real work in Jackson Park began on February 11th, when 50 Italian immigrants employed by MacArthur Brothers, a Chicago company, began digging a drainage ditch. It was nothing. Routine. But word of the work spread, and 500 union men stormed the park and drove the workers off. 2 days later, Friday the 13th, 600 men gathered at the park to protest MacArthur's use of what they alleged were imported workers. The next day, 2,000 men, many armed with sharpened sticks, advanced on MacArthur's workers, seized two, and began beating them. Police arrived. The crowd backed off. MacArthur asked Mayor Krieger for protection. Krieger assigned the city's corporation council, a young lawyer named Clarence Darrow, to look into it. Two nights later, the city's unions met with officers of the fair to demand that they limit the workday to 8 hours, pay union scale wages, and hire union workers before all others. After 2 weeks of deliberation, the fair's directors accepted the 8-hour day, but said they'd think about the rest. There was conflict, too, among the fair's overseers. The National Commission, comprised of politicians and headed by Director General George Davis, wanted financial control. The Exposition Company, run by Chicago's leading businessmen and headed by President Lyman Gage, refused. The company had raised the money, and by God, the company would spend it in whatever way it chose. Committees ruled everything. In his private practice, Burnham was accustomed to having complete control over expenditures needed to build his skyscrapers. Now he needed to seek approval from the Exposition Company's executive committee at every step, even to buy drafting boards. The committee seldom objected to anything Burnham asked for, but it met only once a week, on Wednesdays at 3 o'clock. Thus, each petition, no matter how readily endorsed, squandered time. Maybe just a few hours, maybe an entire week. It was all immensely frustrating. "We must push this now," Burnham said. "The delays have seemed interminable." But he did make progress. He directed a contest to choose a female architect to design the women's building for the fair. Sophia Hayden of Boston won. She was 21 years old. Her fee was the prize money, $1,000. The male architects each got $10,000. There had been skepticism that a mere woman would be able to conceive such an important building on her own. Examination of the facts show that this woman had no help whatever in working up the designs, Burnham wrote. It was done by herself in her home. In March, all the architects acknowledged that if they built their structures as originally planned, out of stone, steel, and brick, the buildings could not possibly be finished by opening day. They voted instead to clad their buildings in staff, a resilient mixture of plaster and jute that could be molded into columns and statuary and spread over wood frames to provide the illusion of stone. "There will not be a brick on the grounds," Burnham said. In the midst of all this, as the workload increased, Burnham realized he could put off no longer the hiring of a designer to replace his beloved John Root. He needed someone to manage his firm's ongoing work while he tended to the exposition. A friend recommended Charles B. Atwood of New York. McKim shook his head. There were stories about Atwood and questions of dependability. Nonetheless, Burnham arranged to meet Atwood in New York at the Brunswick Hotel. Atwood stood him up. Burnham waited an hour, then left for the train station. As he was crossing the street, a handsome man in a black bowler and cape with black gun muzzle eyes approached him and asked if he was Mr. Burnham. "I am," Burnham said. "I'm Charles Atwood. Did you want to see me?" Burnham glared. "I am going back to Chicago. I'll think it over and let you know." Burnham caught his train. Once back in Chicago, he went directly to his office. A few hours later, Atwood walked in. He had followed Burnham from New York. Burnham gave him the job. Atwood had a secret, as it happens. He was an opium addict. It explained those eyes and his erratic behavior. But Burnham thought him a genius. As a reminder to himself and anyone who visited his office in the shanty, Burnham posted a sign over his desk bearing a single word: Rush. Time was so short, the executive committee began planning exhibits and appointing World's Fair commissioners to secure them. In February, the committee voted to dispatch a young Army officer, Lieutenant Mason A. Schufeld, to Zanzibar to begin a journey to locate a tribe of pygmies only recently revealed to exist by explorer Henry Stanley, and to bring to the fair a family of 12 or 14 of the fierce little midgets. The committee gave Lieutenant Schufeld 2.5 years to complete his mission. Beyond the fair's new fence, turmoil and grief engulfed Chicago. Union leaders threatened to organize unions worldwide to oppose the fair. The Inland Architect, a prominent Chicago journal, reported, "That un-American institution, the trades union, has developed its un-American principle of curtailing or abolishing the personal freedom of the individual in a new direction, that of seeking, as far as possible, to cripple the World's Fair." Such behavior, the journal said, would be called treason in countries less enlightened and more arbitrary than ours. The nation's financial condition worsened. Offices in the newest of Chicago's skyscrapers remained vacant. Just blocks from the rookery, Burnham and Root's temperance building stood huge and black and largely empty. 25,000 unemployed workers roamed the city. At night, they slept in police stations and in the basement of City Hall. The unions grew stronger. The old world was passing. P.T. Barnum died. Grave robbers attempted to steal his corpse. William Tecumseh Sherman died too. Atlanta cheered. Reports from abroad asserted, erroneously, that Jack the Ripper had returned. Closer at hand, a gory killing in New York suggested he might have migrated to America. In Chicago, the former warden of the Illinois State Penitentiary at Joliet, Major R.W. McClary, began readying the city for the surge in crime that everyone expected the fair to produce, establishing an office in the auditorium to receive and distribute Bertillon identifications of known criminals. Devised by French criminologist Alphonse Bertillon, the system required police to make a precise survey of the dimensions and physical peculiarities of suspects. Bertillon believed that each man's measurements were unique and thus could be used to penetrate the aliases that criminals deployed in moving from city to city. In theory, a detective in Cincinnati could telegraph a few distinctive numbers to investigators in New York with the expectation that if a match existed, New York would find it. A reporter asked Major McClary whether the fair really would attract the criminal element. He paused a moment, then said, "I think it quite necessary that the authorities here should be prepared to meet and deal with the greatest congregation of criminals that ever yet met in this country." Cuckoldry. At the Holmes Building at 63rd and Wallace, now known widely in the neighborhood as the Castle, the Connor family was in turmoil. Lovely, dark Gertrude, Ned's sister, one day came to Ned in tears and told him she could not stay in the house another moment. She vowed to catch the first train back to Muscatine, Iowa. Ned begged her to tell him what had occurred, but she refused. Ned knew that she and a young man had begun courting and believed her tears must have resulted from something he had said or done. Possibly the two had been indiscreet, although he did not think Gertrude capable of so drastic a moral lapse. The more he pressed her for an explanation, the more troubled and adamant she became. She wished she had never come to Chicago. It was a blighted, hellish place full of noise and dust and smoke and inhuman towers that blocked the sun, and she hated it. Hated especially this gloomy building and the ceaseless clamor of construction. When Holmes came by, she would not look at him. Her color rose. Ned did not notice. Ned hired an express company to collect her trunk and saw her to the station. She still would not explain. Through tears, she said goodbye. The train huffed from the station. In Iowa, in safe, bland Muscatine, Gertrude fell ill, an accident of nature. The disease proved fatal. Holmes told Ned how sorry he was to hear of her passing, but in his eyes there was only a flat blue calm, like the lake on a still August morning. With Gertrude gone, the tension between Ned and Julia increased. Their marriage never had been tranquil. Back in Iowa, they had come close to separating. Now, again, their relationship was crumbling. Their daughter, Pearl, became commensurately more difficult to manage, her behavior marked by periods of sullen withdrawal and eruptions of anger. Ned understood none of it. He was of an easygoing, innocent nature, a reporter later observed. He mistrusted nothing. He did not see what even his friends and regular customers saw. "Some of my friends told me there was something between Holmes and my wife," he said later. "At first, I did not believe it." Despite the warnings and his own mounting uneasiness, Ned admired Holmes. While he, Ned, was but a jeweler in someone else's store, Holmes controlled a small empire and had yet to turn 30 years old. Holmes's energy and success made Ned feel even smaller than he already was inclined to feel, especially now that Julia had begun looking at him as if he had just emerged from a rendering vat at the stockyards. Thus, Ned was particularly susceptible to an offer from Holmes that seemed likely to increase his own stature in Julia's eyes. Holmes proposed to sell Ned the entire pharmacy under terms that Ned, naive Ned, found generous beyond all expectation. Holmes would increase his salary to $18 a week from 12, so that Ned could pay Holmes $6 a week to cover the purchase. Ned wouldn't even have to worry about handling the $6. Holmes would deduct it from the new $18 salary each week automatically. Holmes promised also to take care of all the legal details and to record the transfer with city officials. Ned would get his $12 a week just as always, but now would be the owner of a fine store in a prosperous neighborhood, destined to become even wealthier once the World's Fair began operation. Ned accepted, giving no thought to why Holmes would wish to shed such a healthy business. The offer eased his concerns about Holmes and Julia. If Holmes and she were involved in an indiscreet liaison, would he offer Ned the jewel of his Englewood empire? To Ned's sorrow, he soon found that his new status did nothing to ease the tension between himself and Julia. The ferocity of their arguments only increased, as did the length of the cold silences that filled whatever other time they spent together. Holmes was sympathetic. He bought Ned lunch at the first floor restaurant and told Ned how certain he was that the marriage would be salvaged. Julia was an ambitious woman and clearly a very beautiful one, but she would come to her senses in short order. Holmes's sympathy was disarming. The idea that Holmes might be the cause of Julia's discontent seemed more and more improbable. Holmes even wanted Ned to buy life insurance, for surely once his marital strife subsided, he would want to protect Julia and Pearl from destitution in the event of his death. He recommended that Ned also consider insuring Pearl's life, and even offered to pay the initial premiums. He brought an insurance man, C.W. Arnold, to meet with Ned. Arnold explained that he was building a new agency and wanted to sell as many policies as possible in order to attract the attention of the biggest insurance companies. To secure a policy, all Ned had to pay was $1, Arnold said. Just $1 to begin protecting his family forever. But Ned did not want a policy. Arnold tried again to change his mind. Ned refused and refused, and finally told Arnold that if he really needed $1, Ned would simply give him one. Arnold and Holmes looked at each other, their eyes empty of all expression. Soon, creditors began appearing at the pharmacy demanding repayment of mortgages secured by the store's furnishings and its stock of salves and ointments and other goods. Ned was unaware of the existence of these debts and believed the creditors were trying to defraud him until they presented documents signed by the previous owner, H.H. Holmes. Convinced now that these were bona fide debts, Ned promised to pay them as soon as he was able. Here, too, Holmes was sympathetic, but there was nothing he could do. Any thriving venture accumulated debts. He had assumed that Ned understood at least that much about business. At any rate, it was something to which Ned now would have to become accustomed. The sale, he reminded Ned, was final. This latest disappointment rekindled Ned's uneasiness about Holmes and Julia. He began to suspect that his friends might indeed be correct in believing that Holmes and Julia were engaged in an illicit affair. It would explain the change in Julia, certainly, and might even explain Holmes' sale of the pharmacy. An unstated trade. The store in exchange for Julia. Ned did not yet confront Julia with his suspicions. He told her simply that if her behavior toward him did not change, if her coldness and hostility continued, he and she would have to separate. She snapped, "Separation couldn't come too soon to suit me." But they remained together a short while longer. Their battles became more frequent. Finally, Ned shouted that he was done. The marriage was over. He spent the night in the barber shop on the first floor, directly below their apartment. He heard her footsteps as she moved about on the floor above. The next morning he told Holmes he was leaving and would abandon his interest in the store. When Holmes urged him to reconsider, Ned merely laughed. He moved out and took a new job with a jewelry store in downtown Chicago, H. Purdy and Company. Pearl remained with Julia and Holmes. Ned made one more attempt to win back his wife. I told her after I left the building that if she would return to me and stop her quarreling, we would live together again. But she refused to come back. Ned vowed that one day he would return for Pearl. Soon he left Chicago and moved to Gilman, Illinois, where he met a young woman and began a formal courtship, which compelled him to visit Holmes's building one more time to seek a divorce decree. He got it, but failed to gain custody of Pearl. With Ned gone and the divorce final, Holmes's interest in Julia began to dissipate. He had promised her repeatedly that he would marry her once the decree was confirmed, but now he found the prospect repulsive. Pearl's sullen, accusing presence had become especially unappealing. At night, after the first-floor stores had closed and Julia and Pearl and the building's other tenants were asleep, he sometimes would descend to the basement, careful to lock the door behind him, and there ignite the flames of his kiln and marvel at its extraordinary heat.